From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a reflection on the HIV/AIDS crisis and how it relates to the current pandemic.
One message that applies to both epidemics and pandemics is the importance of information, making sure that people are getting access to information, and the importance of trust.
Plus, music journalist David Hepworth on the year 1971 that gave rise to Marvin Gaye's masterwork, What's Going On, and so much more.
What started to change in 1971 is these artists thinking, no, I can do something over 35 minutes.
Also, rediscovering Idlewild, where generations of Black Michiganders went for vacation and respite.
There's a lot of ancient narrative out there about Idlewild, rise and fall, abandonment, whatever. And the reality of Idlewild, as we've experienced, and as many people up here are experiencing it, is that it never went away.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, we're going to talk with music historian David Hepworth about Motown, Marvin Gaye, and one of the most influential years in music history, 1971.
Nobody could possibly have foreseen that it would have been such a success as it was in the first place in the USA. And also, what nobody could have seen is the kind of cult that's grown up around it in the subsequent 50 years.
But first, 40 years ago this week, the CDC reported a cluster of a rare form of pneumonia among five gay men in Los Angeles. The ensuing pandemic put its mark on a generation of Americans, certainly doctors and healthcare providers, also politicians and pharmaceutical researchers, and most of all, to the millions of Americans diagnosed HIV positive and all of those who loved them. The AIDS crisis was so influential on society and healthcare. It's hard not to think about it as we process this moment in the COVID pandemic. Celeste Watkins-Hayes is a professor of sociology at the University of Michigan. She researches inequality through lenses of gender, race, and class, and she joins us now. Celeste, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's an honor to be with you.
HIV and AIDS had undeniable consequences in how LGBTQ people move through society. Your research also lights up the lives of women, and especially Black women, who contracted HIV and perhaps AIDS afterward. You wrote an entire book about their experiences. What do we know about them? How many women went through getting a positive diagnosis for HIV?
That's a great question. So we know that Black people are disproportionately impacted by the HIV epidemic. And when we look at the numbers, we see those disparities for men and for women. So when I was conducting my research, Black women made up 61% of all women who were living with HIV. HIV was the fourth leading cause of death among Black women ages 35 to 44 when I was conducting my research between 2005 and 2017. So what we see with the HIV epidemic is that it's an epidemic of inequality. We see that groups that are disproportionately impacted by HIV are also groups that are socially marginalized often on the basis of race and gender and sexuality. And Black women absolutely have borne much of the brunt of the epidemic when we look at the trends among women.
For years and years and years, people who were HIV positive got sick and died, and there was not a whole lot done for them. And then over time, drug therapy surfaced, drug prices evolved. What did you observe of how the women you talked to, how they fared over that time?
Well, it was really interesting because when we talk about the story of HIV, there are some notable successes. We now have the science that assists people living with HIV and moves HIV from a death sentence, which is how many of us understood HIV and often experienced HIV in its early years, to moving it into a chronic manageable illness, meaning that if you are able to get tested, get diagnosed, get on medications, antiretroviral therapy, you can live a long life. And in fact, people living with HIV who are taking their medications as prescribed can get to a place where they have undetectable viral loads, which means that they can't sexually transmit. But what we've seen is that the scientific advances have not been enjoyed equally across populations. Part of it is a question of people getting access to information around testing, knowing that they might be at risk, knowing that they should get tested. tested, finding a place to get tested. And then once people find out that they may have HIV or do have HIV, making sure that they're getting consistent access to healthcare. Because what's so critical about managing HIV is an ongoing and lasting relationship with the healthcare system. You've got to regularly see your doctor, your healthcare provider, regularly take your medications and get access to medications and get your blood work checked. So for people who are grappling with stigma and really struggling with their HIV diagnosis and don't want a reminder frequently that they're living with the illness, for those who are economically marginalized, who may not have health insurance and access to consistent healthcare, and for those who are grappling with many, many other life challenges, it becomes difficult to manage an HIV diagnosis in addition to everything else that sometimes people are managing. It's hard to go in and regularly check your viral load and see your doctor and take your medications every day if you are worried about where your next meal is coming from. So the next frontier as it relates to HIV is, yes, a continued scientific push for better medications, better access, thinking about potentials for vaccines, potential for a cure. But for now, highly antiretroviral therapy is proving to be extremely effective at reducing the numbers. But the real frontier we've got to talk about is how we deal with the inequities in terms of who's getting access to those resources. And we also have another very powerful tool in our arsenal to fight the epidemic, and that is PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis. And those are medications that HIV negative people can take to prevent acquiring HIV, to prevent HIV transmission from happening to them. But that too is a question of access. Not a lot of people know about PrEP. So it really becomes incumbent upon people to ask questions of their healthcare providers. And it's also critical for healthcare providers to get better versed on the capabilities and to be able to offer those capabilities to their patients.
What you're saying sounds so familiar in such an awful way, as we are now in a place where Black women and men are, once again, those most being affected by a pandemic, being COVID. We know what to do to inoculate them, and yet the disparities in terms of care and vaccination rates and hospitalization rates in our Black and brown communities in Michigan are just frightening. I feel like some people felt the sheer scale of COVID led people to think there would be a great awakening, but what's not happening right now?
Well, I think that many of the lessons from HIV, some apply to COVID and some don't necessarily apply to COVID. But one message that applies to both epidemics and pandemics is the importance of information, making sure that people are getting access to information, and the importance of trust. The same dynamic happened when highly active antiretroviral therapy became available. People were skeptical. They were concerned about whether they would be effective, what the long-term side effects may be. And it was really the HIV community itself that played a very powerful role in getting the message out, talking to people, you know, talking about their experiences on medication, talking about how they were managing, and that alleviated a lot of the fears. So making sure that we're offering the message, but we're also making sure that the messengers are people that folks trust. So we've got to make sure that we've got a diverse army of people out there talking about vaccines, talking about the importance of getting tested for COVID-19, just as we do during the HIV pandemic. Because one of the things that's really interesting about HIV that I think offers a valuable lesson is the diversity in who's affected. We often think about just one population being affected. In the case of HIV, we often imagine a white gay male patient. But in fact, as I've written about in my book, HIV affects women. It affects a broad spectrum of the LGBTQ community, not just gay men. It affects low-income individuals. There's a number of different populations grappling with the issue. And what the HIV community figured out very effectively is that all of those populations have to be involved in the response. They all have to be involved in messaging and problem solving and creating solutions and figuring out what's going to work for those communities, what's going to resonate in their communities. And I think that if we can borrow those lessons with COVID and develop that diverse army and make sure that the access and the resources are there, I think it'll be very beneficial.
Celeste, when you think about the place that we're in now with HIV, how things went from being a four-alarm fire over decades to becoming more of a manageable chronic disease, and what appears to be something like a step down now in our relationship with COVID, you've outlined very specific steps, but do you have any thoughts on how we keep everyone focused on the people who are at risk?
Exactly, because your question is getting to this point of complacency, this question of complacency, because what we find, and we saw this with HIV, is when the most resourced among us get access to the scientific tools, public awareness goes down, public attention goes down. It doesn't occupy our front pages and the lead stories in our nightly news. And what we see is those most marginalized who are still grappling with the pandemic are often ignored. We saw that with HIV. So, for example, when highly active antiretroviral therapy became available, we actually saw an increase in the number of AIDS deaths among Blacks. And what was happening was that there was decreased attention and decreased focus and resources in ways that some of the most marginalized within the HIV population, in the case of this example, Black people, found themselves under-resourced to fight the epidemic and ended up having high death rates because the most resourced among the HIV community got their medications. They had access to healthcare. They had physicians. They had medications paid for. They had private insurance. And all of that made it so that HIV was not a death sentence, and therefore it didn't have the same kind of public push and public focus. So we've got to think about that in the context of COVID as well, making sure that as the most resourced among us get access to the vaccine, we don't take our eye off the ball and we're still thinking about the most marginalized in our communities who don't have access to resources and how to think about how to bridge that gap.
Professor Celeste Watkins-Hayes, sociologist at the University of Michigan. She's also the author of Remaking a Life, How Women Living with HIV/AIDS Confront Inequality. Celeste, it's a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me on the show.
Coming up, how the music industry in 1971 was ripe for an album like Marvin Gaye's What's Going On.
Those records from that year are still played nowadays by people who weren't around at the time.
That's after the break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. 50 years ago, Marvin Gaye put his notes on the world into song form, culminating in one of the greatest musical works that Detroit ever produced, What's Going On.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.
But he wasn't the only one. Artists all across the industry were pushing themselves creatively. David Hepworth is a music journalist from the UK and the author of the book Never a Dull Moment, 1971, the year that rock exploded. Well, David Hepworth, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So you have a really broad view of the events that were going on across the musical landscape in 1971. Can I just start by asking you, what makes 1971 special for Motown's corner of music in your mind?
Well, kind of all sorts of odd accidents, really, in 1971, because I think the main focus for Motown in 1971 was the enormous success of the Jackson 5 and Dinah Ross as a solo artist. And they were less looking at the people who actually provided the most interesting stuff, who were, of course, Stevie Wonder, who reached the age of 21 in 1971, and so he was able to take control of his career in a way that he hadn't been able to do before. And then Marvin Gaye, who was rather on the back burner in those times, and the success of What's Going On was just one of those bizarre accidents that occur from time to time in the music business. Nobody could possibly have foreseen that it would have been such a success as it was in the first place in the USA. And also what nobody could have seen is the kind of cult that's set up, that's grown up around it in the subsequent 50 years.
Sure. Let's take the bigger picture now. There were so many major albums released in 71. Can you run us through a few of your favorites?
Well, it's the obvious, you know, it's Rolling Stones' Sticky Fingers, Led Zeppelin 4, David Bowie's Hunky Dory, Carol King's Tapestry, Sly and the Family Stone, There's a Riot Going On. You know, all kinds of records there, James Taylor, Mudslide Slim, Joni Mitchell's Blue. I think the thing that fascinates me about it is that those records from that year are still played nowadays by people who weren't around at the time. And whereas I wouldn't wish an evening's 1971 television on my worst enemy, an evening of 1971 music of all kinds tends to slip down perfectly easily with people who are 24 nowadays, as well as people who are in their 60s or their 70s. Because there was something about the way records were made in 1971. And what I think is they had just enough time and not too much. They had just enough money and not too much. They had just enough freedom and not too much. And also, the thing that we do not realize, we think the world of music nowadays moves far more quickly than it moved back then. Not true. It moves far more slowly nowadays than it moved then. So when people wanted to do things in 1971, they just did them. And they did them very, very quickly. And they got out there very, very quickly. And they got response very, very quickly in a way that simply doesn't occur anymore. So you had a load of artists suddenly embracing the possibilities of this new medium, the long playing record, where, you know, because it was a new thing for young performers to be allowed to use it as a canvas to do whatever they wanted to do. And you also had the fact that it was the primary means of entertainment for most people under the age of 30. They weren't watching a lot of television, and clearly there wasn't social media and all that sort of thing.
Right.
So what you had, they benefited from really good listeners at the same time. So when people bought a record in 1971, they really listened to it. They took it home and they played it again and again and again. And so it became very much part of their lives. It became imprinted on them. And that was usually beneficial to the artists.
Marvin Gaye's sound with What's Going On spoke to a lot of political outrage of the day, that certainly that people were feeling in Detroit, Michigan. And yet there was so much going on in the rest of the country and the rest of the world. Can you think of other bands that had watershed records that year that had these overtly political overtones?
Not so much overtly political overtones. I suppose the thing that still fascinates me is that if you look at Christmas 1971, the top selling album in the whole of the United States and was at number one for, I think, about a month, was Sly and the Family Stone's There's a Riot Going On, which is an absolutely extraordinary record in all kinds of ways. You listen to it nowadays, it sounds really advanced. And that was in the mainstream in 1971, because what you didn't have was loads of little specialist musical ghettos like you have nowadays. You didn't have an independent chart, and you had an R&B chart, but it was nothing like specialized as it is nowadays. And so everything was heard by everybody. And that's a really important point, you know. So What's Going On would be played on the radio alongside, you know, I don't know, the Carpenters and Carol King and the Rolling Stones and Brown Sugar and all that kind of thing. It would all part of one kind of mix. And that's a thing that I think we find it very hard to get our heads around nowadays.
I was going to ask you about this. I don't know what to do with the Billboard singles chart from 1971. The Carpenters, Three Dog Night, The Osmonds, The Bee Gees. How do you reconcile?
Well, it's just, it's everything. Everything is there. And, you know, there were certain acts who kind of specialized in singles at that point. There's all kinds of things going on. I mean, what's going on, I think, went to number one in Cashbox, but I don't think it went to number one in Billboard. I think it was at number two. Because I think the thing that kept it off number one was Just My Imagination by The Temptations, another Motown record, and very much in the kind of classic mold of Motown, you know.
Right.
So I think it's dangerous to think that there was suddenly a switch was thrown and Motown threw away its kind of party music heritage and suddenly embraced social consciousness. It wasn't as simple as that. And there were other things that fascinates me about what's going on still today. Is it sounds kind of like a party record.
Yeah.
You know, and people did remark upon at the time. I mean, the chat at the beginning, all that kind of stuff. And so it's got this, I think it accidentally fell upon this thing, combination of kind of anxiety and euphoria that kind of worked for it. And it's something that you still hear in records today. You know, I think they developed, often by accident, a different way of making records. It doesn't have the normal structure. It doesn't have an obvious chorus or anything like that. It kind of floats. It's as if it's faded in and it's faded out at the end. And it could be just going on forever somewhere. That was sure. The feeling it had about it. And, so I think there's an interesting kind of dynamic going on between the kind of, the overt message of the lyrics and the message of the music. I think they were kind of two different things.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with music historian David Hepworth. He's the author of the book Never a Dull Moment, 1971, The Year That Rock Exploded. Some people feel that all of American music is essentially Black music. And in terms of Black artistry, 1971 feels like the edge of a lot of important things. I mean, as you mentioned, Stevie Wonder was about to unleash everything that he was capable of out from under Berry Gordy's control. Funkadelic put out Maggot Brain that year. Bill Withers made his debut with Just As I Am. James Brown and Curtis Mayfield's music were about to go through a big change. Do you think that Marvin Gaye did something for the larger ecosystem by putting this record out and showing that it could be done?
Well, I think he wasn't the only one. I mean, the one you haven't mentioned, which I think was Rolling Stone's record of the year, 1971, was, which nobody talks about anymore, is Al Green Gets Next to You. You know, Al Green was very much at the peak of his powers in 1971. I think what you'd traditionally had was that African-American artists, now I'm looking at this from a British point of view as well, they were celebrated for 7-inch 45s. They were celebrated for short tunes and fantastic dance music and ballads and so forth. And, you know, that applied to Otis Redding as well as Marvin Gaye and all these kind of people. What started to change in 1971 is these artists thinking, no, I can do something over 35 minutes. And all musical artists like doing things over 35 minutes because they think it represents a kind of a level of respect that the 7-inch 45 doesn't deliver for them. And so that's a natural tendency of all performers. And what was happening in 1971 was that, you know, music was a bit of a greenfield site. You know, this was a relatively new medium post Sgt. Pepper 1967. The idea that you would let young artists go and do what they wanted because if you were the record company, you didn't know what the market wanted. They appeared to know what the market wanted. And they tried things. And a huge number of the things that they tried in 1971, nobody had ever tried before. You know, you haven't heard a record like What's Going On before. Nowadays, you can hear loads of records that have shades of What's Going On about them. Back then, you hadn't heard anything like that before. Similarly, you hadn't heard anything like Carole King's Tapestry before, or Joni Mitchell's Blue. These were new things, and the nearest analogy I can provide to that moment is if you look at what's going on nowadays, or what's been going on the last 5 or 10 years, with streaming television, long-form television, where suddenly television is embracing a very different way of telling stories. A similar thing was happening with the long playing record in the early 70s. It was an opportunity to do something that nobody had done before. And that was very exciting. And strangely enough, you could be commercially rewarded for doing something that's quite radical, as was the case with Marvin Gaye. But nobody envisaged it, because what's going on? It was done as a single. Barry Gordy didn't want to put it out. It was only when it was at number one, he thought, we need an album. And then the album was lashed together really, really quickly and put out, was a big success in the USA. In the UK, I'm ashamed to say, it absolutely sank without trace, but that's just one of those things. But, you know, as I say, its cult has grown over the years. It's one of those records that's kind of bigger now than it was at the time. And it was pretty big at the time.
It doesn't sound crazy to me that some of that music wouldn't make much sense outside of an American context. I get that. Do you mind telling us what you were doing in 1971?
Well, I was a student. You know, I was 21. You know, and I was spending every spare piece of cash I had on long playing records, because that's all you wanted. Because, you know, all your entertainment aspirations and desires were in records, and you never passed a record shop without going in and flicking through and seeing what there was. And so, you know, records, long playing records, had a mind share then that I don't think they've had since, simply because there's too many other things nowadays to distract. Whereas back then, they were the thing, particularly if you were, you know, between the age of 15 and 30.
Yeah. What's Going On appears on so many best albums of all time lists. How do you think the record holds up today?
Well, it's not my favorite by any means. It's not my favorite Marvin Gaye album. I think it benefits from what I call the hammock effect of having a really strong opening track and a really strong closing track. Inner City Blues, and which sometimes makes you forgive the fact that it kind of sags a little bit in the middle. That's my personal criticism. But it's hugely popular. It's hugely influential. People absolutely love it. And, you know, and they will continue loving it for many years to come. I don't doubt. And, you know, whatever I feel about its shortcomings are not going to change anybody's view, nor should they.
August, muchachos, spend it all, the have-nots, money, we make it, for we see it, you take it. Oh, make me wanna holler the way they do my life. Yeah. Make me wanna holler the way they do my life. This ain't living, this ain't living. No, no, baby, this ain't living. No, 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 no.
You mentioned that there's a whole generation of inheritors who were able to do long form after the success of What's Going On. Who do you see as some of the inheritors of today of what Marvin Gaye did with What's Going On? I mean, I kind of wonder if we would have had stuff like Black Messiah, or, you know, Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, or maybe even some of the, you know, some of the things that Prince put out over time without someone kicking the door down.
Yeah, but I think that may be true, but I don't think he was the only one who did that, you know. And, you know, like I said earlier, Al Green gets next to you. Sly and the Family Stone, there's a riot going on. You know, there were loads and loads of things going on at that time. What's going on was one of them. And, you know, there was a belief by the end of that year, if it had not been established before, and the person who probably kicked the door open more than anybody else was Stevie Wonder in the subsequent 3 years, was the idea that African-American artists could do albums that were every bit as artistically adventurous as anything Bob Dylan or the Beatles or whatever had done, and could simultaneously be really successful doing it.
Sure.
That was the achievement. Anybody can go off and do something kind of provocative and revolutionary, but to do something provocative and revolutionary and have it on every radio and in every living room, that's the major difference.
David Hepworth is a music journalist and author of 1971, Never a Dull Moment. And if you've got Apple TV, you owe it to yourself to check out the 8-part docuseries that is inspired by his book. It's called 1971, The Year That Music Changed Everything. David, it's a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, we talk about the historical Black Eden, Idlewild, Michigan, and its future for leisure and tourism. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we're going to revisit a conversation about the history and future of Black spaces in Michigan. And to do it, we're going to go up north to a place known as the Black Eden of Michigan. In the last 100 years, the town of Idlewild has been many things: an entertainment and resort space for the who's who of Black celebrity, a peaceful haven when Jim Crow and segregation made safety feel impossible for Black people. And these days, there's a renewed interest in this part of Yates Township, where Black families are still living and where new energy is budding. Earlier this year, I spoke with the creators of Experience Idlewild, which promotes and supports people as they plan their return, either short or long term. Blair Evans is with the Yates Township Planning Commission, and Susan Matus is a property management and tourism entrepreneur. Here's our conversation. Susan, Blair, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What brought you to Idlewild?
Well, my grandparents started coming up here in the 20s. So I have been coming up here all my life. Old family story. I was born in July. My mother was up here in June. So I guess I could say I've been coming up here since before I was born. Yeah. So it's just been a part of my flow.
And then Blair brought me up here close to 15 years ago, and I fell in love with the place. And originally we were just coming up. I was just coming up here as part of our vacation getaway. And then in the last couple years, we transitioned more into the business side of it. And now we're full-time residents.
What do you love about this community?
That's a deep question. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, for me, obviously it brings back, you know, lifelong memories. But I think the reason that it resonates so much is because, one, it's a beautiful place, unspoiled natural resources, clean air, clean water, great recreation, those kind of things. It's got a culture that's unapologetically Black, which is rare to find. And it's got a history of self-determination and community building, which I think is very important, not just for the past arc, but to point towards what we need to be doing in the future also.
Yeah. I guess you could say I'm an outdoorsy person, so I really enjoy having access to the lake and the forest. It's all very healing and rejuvenating to be, you know, here in this little oasis. And born and raised in the city of Detroit, so when I came up here, you know, I knew a few of the people that were here, though I didn't grow up coming here. And, you know, just this tight-knit community, love being able to know my neighbors and work with amazing people that want to come up and be a part of Idlewild's continued legacy, really.
What was the impetus for starting your work with Experience Idlewild?
I think Susan will probably speak to that deeply, but a lot of it was just an opportunity for the people who are up here to have a way to speak their own truth about Idyllwild. There's a lot of ancient narrative out there about rise and fall, abandonment, whatever. And the reality of Idyllwild as we've experienced it, and as many people up here are experiencing it, is that one, it never went away. Mm-hmm. And two, there's a significant kind of reinvention based on basic principles of young people, given the current generations and looking forward to their children and the like. So it was an opportunity to expose people to what is really going on to Idyllwild and to give people an opportunity to understand the cultural events, the recreational events that could give them a taste of what's happening. And we have noticed that once people kind of experience Idyllwild, mm-hmm. It's very impactful.
Mm-hmm. Like I mentioned before, it was our vacation getaway from the city. And then one summer, some folks mentioned to us about this Morton's Motel business that needed help. And just one summer it was, oh, we have a motel and I'm now running it. So we kind of made that work and made that happen quickly. And then once we got our feet wet with that, we saw a need for other ways we could contribute to the community. And after a while, it was just what we had to do. You know, the old saying, if not us, then who? So an experience Idyllwild, we did craft that. We had help from Blair's niece, Nikki Studstill, and she kind of helped us coin that term because we did find once people got up here, most people, they fell in love with Idyllwild and wanted to come back and see and keep participating. And then so we just kind of spun that off from, you know, a catchphrase to our Facebook page and Instagram and then our website. So then it was out there. It was more visible, not just about the, you know, Idyllwild's heyday, but yes, there are people still here, you know, bringing their families back time and time again and enjoying Idyllwild.
There's a whole new heyday that's evolving.
Yes.
And again, it's people, the young folks are creating it in a way that makes sense for them, mm-hmm. which is the way it should happen.
Right. What are you learning about life there as you started to set yourself up?
Well, I think for me, I mean, it was certainly eyes wide open. You know, I was quite familiar with the ins and outs and the goings on. We had kind of gotten to the point where you're here half the year anyway. And most of the interesting things, the interesting people, the most fascinating projects and the like were really centered more around the Idyllwild area than they were any other things that we were doing. And we were doing some pretty interesting other things too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely a privilege and an honor to do this work. But on a practical level, he, you know, even though he came up all his life, so he kind of knew the ins and outs. I, you know, even though I love nature, I was a city girl. So, you know, you have to learn some of the, you know, ways of adjusting to, you know, driving half an hour to go to the grocery store or fixing plumbing or air conditionings when they go out. All those, you know, fun things. But, you know, that's just because we're pretty hands-on. But there are other people that always that we work with who are invaluable in our community that help us out and are supporting not only us, but are the greater goal.
Right. You know, there's this narrative that we all know of Idyllwild as a paradise and a really vibrant and dynamic kind of place. You know, people hear stories about Louis Armstrong and Aretha Franklin and B.B. King coming there as performers. Are you setting out with this effort with the idea of, you know, a kind of restoration or about thinking about what kind of space Idyllwild can and should be in the future?
Good question.
Yes. So, you know, it's a matter of kind of what level of abstraction you're thinking in. You know, Idyllwild, you know, was forged during a time of segregation. And so in those circumstances, you know, those ideas of, you know, a safe space for mental health reasons and, you know, a place to build community wealth and a place to exercise self-determination and to allow people to really kind of manifest themselves amongst other people who respect them as first-class citizens was something that was very important in Idyllwild. And Idyllwild was, you know, really built nuts and bolts by the Black folks who inhabited Idyllwild. You know, I think the need for spaces that are authentically safe for Black folks is as important now as it was then. The need for folks to kind of understand how to fully participate in all of the avenues of township civic life. You know, you can get lost in larger places and feel like you're always just battered by things that are out of your control. You know, in this space, you can actually kind of wrap your arms around things that are going on and understand, you know, what your value is and how you can contribute in unique ways in the community. And so, you know, I think we're trying to restore the purpose of Idyllwild, mm-hmm. but the circumstances in, you know, 2020 are different than they were in 1920. And so we're reinstantiating the same principles with respect for the fact that, you know, the circumstances have changed, but the importance of the place hasn't.
Are there ways that those ideas influence the work that you're trying to do?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the work that we do is kind of platform and enabling work. Mm-hmm. You know, we've worked on providing infrastructure so that people who want to do things have an ability to do it. You know, part of it is, you know, kind of understanding that the whole community kind of creates a place. But another major part of it is, as you start looking at how this evolves, you know, you start dealing with those issues of what is community and what is wealth creation. You know, how do you democratize the ways for people to participate and create value for themselves? Mm-hmm. You know, even though they may not be rich in capital, mm-hmm. they may be rich in those things that people find value in. And how do you create the kind of experience in the arts and culture, but also in the economics and in the institutional structures where people can benefit from the contributions that they make? So, you know, if the community is vibrant and wealthy overall, everybody doesn't have to try to create their own little isolated, I've got everything I need. Mm-hmm. I can rely on the community. I need enough for me, but the value is in the interaction with other people and in the value of the community that we're creating.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Blair Evans and Susan Matus. They co-founded Experience Idyllwild, and they've been active in different ways to build on the legacy of Idyllwild as a safe recreational destination for Black Americans from Michigan and beyond. As a practical matter, what are some of the barriers that you're trying to break down and some of the things that you're trying to make possible? Say someone wants to, you know, start an Airbnb or, you know, like a small resort there. What are the tools that you're trying to build for them?
Well, you know, one, joining the Planning Commission is to have kind of a coherent master plan that actually respects the unique qualities of Idyllwild and Yates Township. And some of it is, you know, lodging, a restaurant, and food services. I mean, you got events, you have a major load, and then you have other times there's a minimal load. That's kind of difficult for folks to manage in terms of the gaps and the spikes in that. So helping people kind of develop a calendar so there's a normal rhythm. Right. It can be as simple as that. But also, many, many folks are doing events, and events have common needs. You know, security is a need. Emergency management and coordination is a need. Everybody doesn't have to reinvent a way of doing that if we're all using the same space, right? So if we all invest in coming up with some common ways of making that happen, it's less expensive and more effective for everybody to kind of do it that way. So, you know, a lot of folks have an idea to swing for the fences when they come up for their first event. And we generally kind of talk to folks about, you know, doing a small version first so that you can know what's here and what's not and what you do and don't know. Right. And then after you kind of figure out, you know, I can't run down the street and do this, mm-hmm. You know, as I would in Grand Rapids or as I would in Detroit, then, you know, here's the stack of things that it takes to make this happen. Here's a part of that that is really my expertise as an event coordinator. Here's the part that I need to do just because it needs to be done. And if we can analyze the similarities of that, then one of the other entrepreneurs may want to take that as a service to provide to everybody. Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of thing.
What are some kinds of programming that you've worked on at Idyllwild over the years?
I mean, we've been involved with a lot of people's programming. You know, we've done some specific things like bringing the Smithsonian documentary on the Green Book here, because Idyllwild was featured in that, you know, as a showing. We've had community conversations about the history of Idyllwild, et cetera. But we support and provide infrastructure to a lot of the people who are doing music festivals and film festivals and spoken word festivals and recreational activities and, you know, biking activities and lake activities, et cetera. Yeah, there's a whole network of entrepreneurs who are doing things, which we're happy to help them be successful.
We're in a position right now where a lot of Michigan's, shall we say, water-adjacent real estate is going through a period of pretty high demand right now. As you think about Idlewild's future and what you're both trying to build, are there concerns or considerations that you have about how growth happens and how building happens that will support the kind of safe community that you're talking about?
Well, yeah, they're certainly not making any more lakefront property. That's, you know, the old saying. And, I mean, property prices in Idlewild have gone up significantly just over the last 3 or 4 years. A lot of that is due to the resurgence of a lot of the events and the like that are going on. People come up, get interested in the place, and are buying, and are putting pressure on the property values. But we're also trying to create the opportunity to have high-value property that's not just necessarily the limited amount that's on the lake, mm-hmm. and to provide ways of cooperatively owning and utilizing the property that is on the lake. You know, a lot of lakefront property, people may use it 2 or 3 weeks out of the year if they own it individually. But there are ways of multiple people collaborating on the same piece of property. You know, we helped start an artist collaborative up here on one of the lakes. And so they collectively kind of purchase property, and they're organizing their programming and utilizing the space to timeshare it in reasonable ways. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you may have 6 or 7 people who then have the same value they would have gotten out of one place, you know, individually, without all the headache of trying to manage the place by themselves. And so that gets back to kind of cooperative and collaborative work and democratizing access to things in different ways.
And we work with the Lake Association as well as the Lot Owners Association here in Idlewild. And because as people are reengaging and more people are coming up, we do want people to be educated and respectful of not only the Idlewild community and its history, but the land and the water too.
Obviously, just about all vacation areas are going through huge demand right now because of COVID, and people have been just desperate to get away and to get a break from daily life. What kinds of things are you telling people who have questions now about coming to Idlewild this summer?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we could start with last summer. Mm-hmm. You know, we were very cautious and conservative. You know, Idlewild is a community that has a lot of, the people have a lot of risk factors. We don't have a huge healthcare infrastructure. We have an aging population that's the year-round population, mm-hmm. The usual range of comorbidities. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we were very cautious about having a lot of traffic come into the community during times when we didn't know what the arc of the pandemic was going to look like. And I'm glad we did, because the arc of the pandemic did not look good. Mm-hmm. This year, it's still, you know, unclear. There's a race, you know, between certain interventions and, you know, variants and mutations and that kind of thing. You know, we have been, you know, talking to people about longer term stays, you know, week to week, as opposed to quick kind of in and outs, mm-hmm. to, you know, allow people to kind of come and appreciate the lakefront cottage or that kind of thing, but not in the same way that they'd be out and about in the community. When the community is vulnerable to some of the impacts of the pandemic. So I'd say 2021 is probably going to start ramping up a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, 2020 basically had a full calendar from late June through September, every weekend.
Yeah.
Everybody who was on that schedule is still very intent on doing projects in the future.
Yes.
They're basically all of them individually decided that they didn't want to expose the community, mm-hmm. to risk from their events. And so we're just having conversations with everybody now about how 2021 is going to go. And I don't think everybody knows specifically, but I think folks are tentatively planning on outdoor, socially distanced type events that may be feasible this summer for 2021.
Yes, we've gotten quite a few requests from people to, you know, for booking their vacation stays to the event directors, you know, and everybody's cautious and just trying to, you know, just kind of wait it out to see what's the best way to make it happen safely here in Idlewild again.
Susan Matus and Blair Evans are the creative forces behind Experience Idlewild. Blair is a member of the Yates County Planning Commission, and Susan is a property management and tourism entrepreneur, and they both live there. Blair, Susan, it's been great talking to you. You guys stay safe up there, and we're wishing you all the best for spring and summer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate you guys reaching out to us.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovett, and Chantel Phillips. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thank you for listening. See you tomorrow.